Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 241, November 3rd. We're going to finish up muscle today, or almost finish up muscle today. And then there's just one more chapter that's left before the next exam. Let's take a look at the schedule. So I turn some of these lights down. There, that works. All right, so today is the 3rd. So where are we? Wow, we're way down here, almost done with the class. Right, and then so we're going to do blood, heart, and circulation. Got a couple lectures on that. A week and a half from today is your next exam. Okay, exam number 3, chapters 10, 11, 12, and 13. So we're almost done. We basically just got to cover a little bit at 12 and then chapter 13. And then after that, just a couple more chapters. 4 more chapters, and that's it. All right, does anybody have a question on the schedule? People are still coming to look at their exam from last time, which is okay. But sooner or later, I'll lose them. So come and see them sooner rather than later if you want to see them. All right, so that's the schedule. Anybody have any questions from last time? We started the muscle stuff and basically just reviewed things that you learned in anatomy. Like, what's a fascicle, what's a cell, the connective tissue sheaths around all the fascicles and cells and around the whole muscle, what's a tendon, all that kind of stuff. And then we were talking about that structural and functional unit of muscle contraction. And what would you call, I tell you what is, answer this question first, what's the structural and functional unit of life? That's a cell, nice. Let's see, what else? Structural and functional unit of communication between cells. A synapse, right? All right, so if you know how one synapse is put together, you pretty much know how many, many cells in your body communicate with each other. If you know how a cell is put together, you pretty much know how all life works, right? Because that's the structural and functional unit. For skeletal muscle, there's a structural and functional unit, and if you understand how that one little unit works, then you pretty much know everything about skeletal muscle. And so what is that unit called in skeletal muscle, which is the structural and functional unit? That is the sarcomere, right? So you got to know some components, the ends of the sarcomere, and I'm going to go over this pretty quick because I'll use this in today's discussion, but the ends of a sarcomere are what we call the Z-discs or Z-lines. And attached to these Z-discs are actin myofilaments. These are real thin, and so that forms a light band when we look at the structure of a myofibril. And then there's another kind of myofilament, which is a thick filament. That's the myosin. We find those in the middle of the sarcomere. And then on the other end of the sarcomere, we have some more actin. And these things overlap each other. They're not in the exact same line. Right, so here I see actin, down below it is myosin. And then down below that is another actin. And if you look at a transverse section through a myofibril, you're going to see that every myosin molecule or filament is surrounded by actin. And every actin is going to be surrounded by myosin basically just because of the arrangement between them. And that's important because there's going to be a very important interaction between actin and myosin. And it's not just in one dimension, it's what? In all three dimensions, 360 degrees around. Okay, so I think maybe last time I was going to get to this point. We know that a sarcomere shortens, right? So when a sarcomere shortens, the Z-discs get closer together. So this top row right here, the sarcomere is relaxed, right? The next row, what can you tell me about this sarcomere? It's shorter, right? So that sarcomere is starting to contract. And what about this last row? It's even a lot shorter still, right? And so that's what we call contraction. So what's happening with these myofilaments? It took people a little while to figure this out, maybe a couple of Nobel Prizes, right? So the question is, which of these filaments shorten? Is it the myosin or is it the actin that caused these Z-discs to come together? And remember, we're just talking about a sarcomere, but a myofibril will have thousands of these things right next to each other, right from end to end, top to bottom. So it's just not the contraction of one sarcomere that produces tension, but it's, what, thousands and thousands of them. All right, so I'm going to turn a light on. We'll just do a little bit of an experiment. All right, so I got a couple markers right here, and you can kind of see what their length is. So we'll make this blue one be actin and the black one myosin. Yeah, that's nice because on the figure the blue is actin anyway, right? All right, so, and my hands are going to be the Z disc, like this. All right, so there's going to be, they're going to be pointing into the center of the sarcomere like that. All right, so how can you explain my hands coming closer together without any of these markers shortening? Because I can't make a marker shorter, can I? I could push all I want, but it's not going to get any shorter. So how are my hands going to come closer together if the markers can't get any shorter? They're going to slide over each other like that. Right? So do you see my hands coming closer together, but the markers aren't changing length whatsoever? So these are the myofilaments. We describe how the sarcomere shortens with the sliding filament mechanism. So these filaments slide over each other. And as a matter of fact, we can even see this on the slide over here. Right? I see a little bit of overlap in the first row. I see more overlap in the second. And here is pretty much complete overlap to where the sarcomere is just the length of that myosin molecule. But if you look at myosin in row 1, row 2, and row 3, same length. If you look at actin, row 1, row 2, row 3, same length. You could get out a ruler and go ahead and measure that. So, no biofilament shortens, they just slide over each other. So we want to be aware of how that happens. I'm going to turn the lights off. All right, so let's take a bit more in-depth look of actin and myosin. So, down on the bottom we have the thick filament, you know that to be myosin, and there are some pieces, like burrs, sticking off of the myosin molecule. And they're going to point up toward an actin filament. And when we look at the actin filament, we can see that it's actually made up of a number of pieces. Globular proteins that are lined up from end to end, right? And if we string a bunch of globular proteins together, then it looks like a filament. And there's these two strands of globular actin. There's another molecule that is long and linear that kind of just spirals around with a globular actin on both of the strands. And we're going to call that tropomyosin. All right, so we have two kinds of proteins that make actin. We have the globular actin, we got tropomyosin, and you see a third one. To me it looks like yellow. And we're going to call that troponin. Troponin associates itself very closely with tropomyosin. All right, so we got three kinds of filaments that make actin. There is a binding site on a globular actin protein that will bind what we call the head group on a myosin molecule. All right, so here is a myosin head, here is a myosin tail. So that's just a projection or a process coming off of a myosin molecule. And here is a binding site on the head of the myosin molecule that can actually fit into an active site in this globular actin molecule. Right now it can't because it's hidden underneath the tropomyosin. Right? But normally it would like to bind there. All right, let me describe something else. So here is the tailpiece, here's the head, and this region right here, you could almost consider this like an elbow on your upper appendage. Right? It's an articulation. This protein can be in a flexed position like what I see over here, or maybe in an extended position that I see on the other part of the slide. So that's the head and the tailpiece. The head has an active site for ATP. All right, so it can fit into the head group, and it's an ATPase, so it can hydrolyze ATP. And what can you tell me about ATP? It's an energy carrier molecule. Right, so when ATP is hydrolyzed, it releases energy, and what happens is that it forces a conformation in this head group and tailpiece to where it extends. It forms a nice straight line. When that happens, then this binding site for actin can reach up and fit exactly into the active site in this globular protein. Okay, so now there's attachment between actin and myosin. This attachment is what we call a cross bridge. But ATP is necessary for this cross bridge to form. And this extended form is due to the hydrolysis of ATP. So what do you get when ATP is hydrolyzed? ADP and inorganic phosphate, and energy. The energy has gone into extending this cross bridge, and when it's extended, it can bind to this actin molecule. Okay, so how do these filaments slide over each other? Well, we have the cross bridge form between myosin and actin, right? The actin binding site is attached to the globular actin. When ATP is hydrolyzed, you're left with ADP and inorganic phosphate. And when inorganic phosphate leaves, and you could just leave ADP right there, but when inorganic phosphate leaves, that causes a conformation in this cross bridge to where it goes back to this flex condition. Right? And when it does, it's going to pull the actin molecule to the right. Right? Or, you know, it could pull the myosin over to the left, either way you want to think about it. But the myosin slides over the actin. Right, so now we have ADP and the ATP binding site. The myosin head group is still bound to actin. And so I actually want to show you something about what we call cross-bridge cycling. How does this repeat itself over and over and over again so a sarcomere can keep shortening? But here is an important point on the slide. Depending on what textbook you read and the latest literature, you might hear different things. But in this particular class, I want you to know what causes the power stroke. Right? The power stroke goes when a cross bridge goes from an extended form to this flexed form. And when that happens, that causes sliding of the myofilaments. And in this class, I want you to say the release of inorganic phosphate from the ATPase and the myosin head group. Okay, when inorganic phosphate leaves, that causes the power stroke, which is what? A change in conformation of the cross bridge, sliding the filaments over each other. So here is a nice slide, probably an exam figure, of what we call cross bridge cycling. Everything we need to know about how filaments slide over each other is contained in this slide. All right, so let's start with step number 5 over here. I'm not going to start with number 1, but I'm going to start with number 5. And with number 5, do you see that the myosin head group, okay, the question is the myosin head group attached to actin or is it not attached to actin?
No.
It's not attached, right? All right, and then an ATP molecule binds to the head group, so this is where we're going to start. So there's energy in the ATP. What condition is this myosin in, flexed or extended? It's flexed, and when it's in the flexed position, it can't bind to the actin molecule. So how do we get it into that extended position? Hydrolyzed ATP that causes that conformation change, right? So now that cross bridge is in an extended form in this particular conformation, then it can bind to the actin molecule, right? But that requires the hydrolysis of ATP. Since it's in this extended condition, right, it can bind to the actin, which is what I see over here. The cross bridge is still extended, but as soon as inorganic phosphate leaves, what happens? The power stroke, right? So that causes the power stroke when inorganic phosphate is released and ADP is released. And when ADP is released, I see the release of ADP. Now the binding site for ATP is open on the myosin head group. And what can bind to the ATP binding site? So here I have another ATP molecule. All right, so when I see myosin head group right after it going through the power stroke, and there's no ATP in the binding site, is it attached or detached from the actin? Right here on this particular part of the slide. Is the head group attached to actin or detached? It is attached, right? And when the head group is attached like that, then the filaments can't slide over each other. They're kind of glued in position, right? So when ATP binds to the binding site, that's when the head group releases from the actin molecule, and we see that over here, right? ATP in the binding site, there's a separation between actin and myosin, and the cycle can repeat itself, right? With the hydrolysis of ATP causes the cross bridge to go into an extended condition, which then allows it to bind to the actin molecule, and that extension is caused by the release of energy when ATP is hydrolyzed. And then when you have inorganic phosphate, the head group bound to actin, when inorganic phosphate leaves, that causes the power stroke. Eventually ADP is going to leave, so a new ATP can come in, right? But before ATP comes in, actin and myosin are stuck together. You notice that right there? All right, so myosin releases actin after ATP binds, right? And so we get to this position over here. So the release of myosin from actin is caused by the binding of ATP to the myosin head group. And then when it's hydrolyzed, that makes this cross bridge go back to an extended form, and this goes around and around and around like that. All right, so I got a question for you. What happens, right, if we have a sarcomere and we remove ATP from that muscle or from that sarcomere? What's going to happen? I see this condition right here. Myosin is going to be attached to actin, and without ATP, it can never let go. Right, without ATP. And that kind of explains a paradoxical kind of phenomena that we know happens to people after they die. It's called rigor mortis, when people's muscles stay in a contracted form. And I think for students it's pretty confusing, because we know that ATP is necessary for muscle contraction to take place, but at this molecular level, what is ATP really necessary for? The disassociation of myosin and actin. Without ATP, that muscle is going to stay contracted. It can't shorten after that period of time. Right? And of course, when that person is dead, those muscles aren't getting oxygen, mitochondria aren't working, ATP is not being produced. Right? So there is this forever attachment of myosin to actin, causing that condition that we call rigor mortis. All right, so what causes the release of the myosin head group from actin? Binding of ATP. What causes the power stroke? The release of inorganic phosphate, right? And remember that the myosin head group can really only reattach itself to an actin when it's in an extended form. And it gets to that extended form by hydrolyzing ATP, right? So it's interesting that the power stroke is not directly caused by the hydrolysis of ATP. It's indirectly caused, right? That energy is stored in that extended form of the cross bridge. So that is kind of interesting. Well, we just talked about how muscle contracts, but a muscle is not contracting all the time. Sometimes it contracts, sometimes it's relaxed. So we're interested in learning about how muscle contraction is controlled, and that has to do with the troponin and tropomyosin complexes on the actin myofilament. Right. So here I see the long, stringy tropomyosin molecules, and then here are the smaller troponin molecules, and they're associated with tropomyosin. So there's something special that has to happen. When I look at this slide, I don't see any binding sites on the G-actins, or this globular actin right here, where the myosin head group needs to bind to it. Right, so the tropomyosin is blocking access for the myosin head group. Myosin can't bind when tropomyosin is in this condition. Right, so how is it then that the myosin head group can bind to the G-actin? And it has to do with calcium. Right, calcium will bind to troponin. And when it binds to troponin, that's like poking you in the side, it's going to cause a conformation change. It's attached to tropomyosin. And that's going to cause a conformation change in tropomyosin, and that's going to uncover the myosin binding site on these G-actin molecules. Maybe the next slide I can see it. Ah, this is a good slide. Probably should have showed you this first. All right, so here I see that there's no cross bridge formed, right? So myosin is separated from actin, and it's in an extended form, right? So it's possible for this myosin head group to bind to actin. But here is the binding site for myosin on the G-actin. And it's blocked. It's covered by the tropomyosin. So myosin wants to bind, but it can't because tropomyosin is in the way. Troponin, associated with tropomyosin, has a binding site for calcium over here. When calcium levels increase around this sarcomere, calcium binds to troponin, causes a conformation change in tropomyosin. It gets out of the way. Right? And the myosin head group right here is in that extended conformation and is going to bind to the binding site on actin, which is what we see on the bottom picture. Right? Calcium bound to, you should know what molecule binds calcium. and that is troponin. Troponin is connected to tropomyosin. When calcium binds to troponin, moves tropomyosin out of the way. Now I can see that the actin binding site can bind to the myosin binding site on the G protein. And this cross bridge can go back to the flex condition when what happens? When energetic phosphate is released, right? So going from here to here, that's what we call the power stroke due to release of energetic phosphate. And then ADP is left within the binding site. It eventually will leave. And at that particular time, when ADP leaves, myosin is still stuck to actin. It can't release itself. It's just stuck. What causes the release of actin and myosin? Actin from myosin is going to be when ATP binds here, right? It's going to cause, right, the release of myosin from actin, and then when ATP is hydrolyzed, this cross bridge is going to go back to an extended condition, just like that. All right, so this is why calcium is so important for muscle contraction, because it controls the association between actin and myosin, right? And if there is ATP available, then there's going to be cycling of cross bridges, right, going from an extended to flexed form, and that's going to pull the actin molecule right over the myosin molecule. All right, so you know what? I want to end the show, and I think I have a couple videos right here. Maybe we'll look at this one first. All right, so when I look at this video, I don't know, can I make it any bigger? Maybe not. How about if I do Control Plus? No. Okay. Well, hopefully, okay, I was impatient. All right, so here's the Z-disc. Here's the Z-disc, and in between the Z-discs, we find the, what do we find between Z-discs? The sarcomere, right, the sarcomere. Sarcomere has myofilaments, and you know them to be actin and myosin. You can see myosin is the thick filament, and I can see the tailpiece and the headpiece of the myosin molecule that's going to form a cross bridge. Right? And in this particular case, myosin is not attached to actin. Ah, so tell me something about calcium in this particular condition. I don't see any cross bridge formed, which means myosin can't attach itself to actin. What do you know about calcium in that state? It is low, or almost zero, right? And as calcium increases, right, that's going to get tropomyosin out of the way, then this head group here can bind to actin, and if there's ATP, there will be cross-bridge cycling. And when that happens, these filaments are going to slide over each other. So, let's see if it makes sense. I got the video. All right, so there's that calcium binding to, you should know what it binds to, troponin. That's going to move tropomyosin out of the way. So now I see some binding sites for the myosin head group. And ATP has been hydrolyzed, so this cross bridge is in an extended form. There's calcium, right, bound. And when inorganic phosphate leaves, what happens? It's going to flex. And there it flexes, and it slides the actin molecule over the myosin molecule. Now it can't release unless what molecule is available? ATP. ATP is going to come in, bind to the myosin binding site. When it does, it releases from actin. And when ATP is hydrolyzed, what happens? It goes back to this extended condition that gives you inorganic phosphate, right? And now it can bind once again. I hope it's going to bind before this inorganic phosphate is released. Right, it's working on it. Yes, it binds. Then inorganic phosphate is released. That causes that conformation change, more sliding, and that process just repeats itself over and over and over again. All right, so that's the importance of calcium, how it interacts with troponin, how troponin interacts with tropomyosin. And troponin should remind you of another kind of modulator protein that binds calcium that can change activity of enzymes inside cells. Troponin is a cousin molecule to the one I want you to know the name of. And you know the name of it already. There's a molecule inside cells. In particular, we looked at it in a synaptic terminal. When calcium floods that synaptic terminal, it binds to a protein, changes the activity of enzymes. which then move vesicles of neurotransmitter to the presynaptic membrane. Okay, and that's called Kelmodulin. So Kelmodulin and troponin are like cousin molecules. They're very similar. They both bind calcium. Right? Kelmodulin, in that case, is important for synaptic transmission. Troponin, in this particular case, is important for muscle contraction. And that is the reason why calcium is at a low concentration inside the cell and high outside the cell, because it acts as a signaling molecule for contraction and synaptic transmission. Okay, so that is something about troponin, tropomyosin, and here's just another, let's take a look at that. This is probably a really short one. All right, so here's that G-actin binding site for the myosin head group. It's attached, right? So we know ATP has to come in and bind before there's release, so before the myosin head group can release actin. Don't know if the video has it. Maybe it has it coming in. Maybe not. Okay, these videos are in Blackboard for you to look at again. And you can read the text down over here or listen to. Ah, let me pause. What do we call that just happened? The power stroke. Now, what caused the power stroke that we didn't see on this particular video? The release of inorganic phosphate caused that power stroke. All right, so now myosin is glued to actin. How is it going to be released from actin? ATP binding. Okay, I don't know if this has it on the video, but we might see the release take place. Ah, ATP, nice. Bound, okay. And then when ATP is hydrolyzed, then this cross bridge goes back to that extended position, it binds, right, and then causes another power stroke. Okay, nice. And that just repeats itself over and over and over again. All right, so let me pause that and look at the overall view. Right, so I see a couple sarcomeres here. There's number one on the left, number two on the right. I see the myosin molecule, actin, attached to the Z discs. I see cross bridges already attached to the actin molecules. So how is it that these Z lines are going to come closer to each other? By sliding of actin over myosin, and hopefully that's what we're going to see right here. Yeah, so somebody's just showing you myosin, actin, H zone due to just overlap of myosin, but no actin. Ah, there it goes. It's starting to contract. You see the flexion and extension of all these cross bridges, and now you kind of know what's happening at the molecular level to cause that to happen. And the Z discs come closer together. And in this particular case, it looks like the sarcomere here has shortened to the max, because the myosin filaments look like they're bumping up against the Z lines, and so that sarcomere can't get any shorter at that particular period of time. All right, I'm going to move back to the beginning of this video. Okay, so what can you tell me about the association, just the physical state of actin and myosin when the sarcomere is relaxed but it's able to contract? What can you tell me about actin and myosin, their relative relationship to each other, just in space? Is it like tip to tip? Or is there overlap? There is overlap. And the reason why I'm asking you that question is that instead of shortening the sarcomere, let's stretch it out. And I can't do that, so you're going to have to just use your mind a little bit. Let's stretch out this sarcomere, right? And remember, the actin is glued to the Z line, so the actin is going to move to the right or to the left. Myosin is attached to that M line right in the middle of the H zone. It can't move, but if we stretch it out, what happens to the overlap of actin and myosin as I stretch this sarcomere out? Right? That region of overlap is going to decrease, and if we stretch it out some more, that overlap is going to decrease some more, and if we stretch it out a lot, what happens to the overlap of actin and myosin? There is no overlap of actin and myosin when that happens. And if there's no overlap of actin and myosin, can that sarcomere contract anymore? No, there has to be overlap, right? So the sarcomere has to have the right length in order to produce tension. And that's going to be an important point in a couple slides coming up. We call that a length-tension relationship. All right, but we're not quite there yet. So we saw cross-bridge cycling, how a sarcomere shortens, and we want to now, so we call that sliding filament mechanism. We need to understand pretty much the whole mechanism, and we call that whole mechanism the excitation-contraction coupling mechanism. All right, so here I see a muscle fiber, right? Many nuclei, it's a multi-nucleate cell, and inside the muscle fiber, what's another name for muscle fiber? Muscle cell. Yeah, so we're looking at a whole cell. Here's a nucleus. If we look around in there, hopefully we find some mitochondria. Oh yeah, we do, right? I see some mitochondria. Mitochondria are organelles just like the nucleus. And I see another organelle right here that's endoplasmic reticulum, but it doesn't have ribosomes, so that is smooth ER. Kind of forms like a net or meshwork over some organelles that aren't contained in other kinds of cells except skeletal muscle. I see one here. I see one here. And here, 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 here. These are called, anybody remember what these organelles of contraction are called? They're called myofibrils. Myofibrils. So myofibrils are the building block of a muscle fiber. Okay, what's the building block of a myofibril? Myofilaments, right? And how many myofilaments are you aware of? Two, actin and myosin, right? Okay, so here we see a myofibril loaded with myofilaments, and here's a sarcomere followed by another one, right? So the myofibrils have sarcomeres lined up end to end, and all these neighboring myofibrils do as well. And that's what gives this muscle fiber that striated appearance, because all these sarcomeres line up together. Okay. All right, so what did we say allowed the binding of myosin to actin? Okay, there has to be something inside the cell or inside the myofibril that allows binding. The ATP is necessary for cycling, but what's going to allow, what's the signal for that allows binding? The calcium signal, right? All right, so normally when a muscle is relaxed, there's no calcium within these myofibrils, but in order to get the muscle to contract, then calcium then floods this area and it causes shortening of these sarcomeres. All right, so where does that calcium come from? In a skeletal muscle cell, calcium comes from the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And in a skeletal muscle cell, we call that the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So when a nerve impulse stimulates this muscle fiber, we have action potentials that travel over the surface of the cell. That action potential is being propagated because the sarcolemma, so the sarcolemma is the plasma membrane of a skeletal muscle cell. Why does an action potential propagate over the surface of a skeletal muscle cell? Because what kind of membrane protein does it have? Action potentials are due to? So an action potential is what? Sodium moving in, potassium leaving out. It's due to those gated channels. What kind of gated channels are they? What controls them? Yeah, voltage gated channels, right? So an action potential travels over the surface of the skeletal muscle cell because the sarcolemma has voltage gated channels in it. They open, sodium runs in, okay? And remember, how is an action potential propagated? Does it die away or does it just stay the same no matter where it goes? Stays the same, right? So if an action potential is over here on the skeletal muscle cell, it's going to travel over the whole surface of the skeletal muscle cell, right? And that's going to be the excitation of the skeletal muscle cell. But look at these myofibrils deep inside the fiber. They can't appreciate, they can't sense or be aware of an action potential on the surface of the muscle cell. So there is a special place, right, that we call a transverse tubule, which I see right here. Transverse tubule is an extension of the cell membrane that goes deep inside all the way across the muscle fiber, and in this tube right here are voltage-gated channels, which means what can enter deep inside of a cell? An action potential, right? So action potential is not trapped on the surface of the cell. It goes everywhere inside the cell as well because of these tubes These tubes are called transverse tubules, right? Because we're looking at a transverse section right here of a muscle fiber cell. When an action potential moves through the transverse tubule, then that's going to cause release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Right, and we're going to look at that mechanism. So that is pretty much the whole excitation-contraction coupling mechanism. Right, so there's voltage-gated channels, and then there's a special interaction between voltage changes in the transverse tubule and opening of calcium channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Let's take a look at the... Oh, I'm not in slideshow mode, sorry. Ah, that's better. Okay, so a little bit bigger. All right, so these... Probably it's nice that you can see the transverse tubule in a different color than the sarcoplasmic reticulum. What's inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum? Calcium, high levels of calcium. Because if there's calcium floating around, I need my cursor back, sorry. If there's calcium floating around within the myofibril or the cytosol, there are calcium pumps that grab it from the cytosol and pump it back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And that requires ATP. So what kind of process do you call that? Active transport. And I said it uses ATP, so what kind of active transport? Primary active transport. It's a pump, just like the sodium-potassium ATP pump, right? It's primary active transport. All right, so calcium is maintained at a low concentration in the myofibril because those pumps are working all the time. The sarcoplasmic reticulum releases calcium only when there's an action potential traveling down the transverse tubule. All right? And then it releases a lot of calcium, but then eventually the pumps take over, pump calcium back out. What happens to this muscle fiber when the calcium pumps pump all that calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum? So calcium can no longer bind to troponin. Troponin then can no longer keep tropomyosin away from the binding sites on the G-actin. And the myosin binding sites on G-actin become covered up, and then cross bridges can't form. That causes relaxation of that skeletal muscle fiber. Right? So low calcium causes muscle contraction. High calcium causes contraction, or actually better to say sliding of those myofilaments over each other. All right, so let's zoom in to this one area. All right, I'll go back one slide. So here's sarcoplasmic reticulum. We can see that there's a little network right here. Then these areas of sarcoplasmic reticulum next to the transverse tubule, you can tell it's a little bit thicker. It's a little bit more diameter. These areas store more calcium than this network over here. We call this a terminal cistern or terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Right? And on either side of this transverse tubule, I see another terminal cisternae. Sometimes these three structures together, the transverse tubule and the cisternae on either side, is called a triad. Sometimes you call that a triad. Maybe you remember that from anatomy. Okay. So let's look at that triad. Let's zoom into a triad, which is what? Terminal cisternae, transverse tubule, another terminal cisternae right here. So a nerve impulse, which we know is an action potential in motion, comes down, flows over this axon terminal. That opens up calcium channels, which moves these vesicles filled with neurotransmitter to the presynaptic membrane. And then it causes release of that neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. Neurotransmitter diffuses from high concentration to low concentration over to the postsynaptic membrane. So the presynaptic membrane is from the somatic motor neuron. The postsynaptic membrane is the skeletal muscle cell. This is what we call the neuromuscular junction. Right? And we just see a couple pieces of this one axon, but it's extensive, right? It's very, very extensive. So what's the neurotransmitter that this somatic motor neuron is going to release? Acetylcholine, 100% of the time. Right? And I see some binding sites for acetylcholine in the postsynaptic membrane. Right? And you can tell me what kind of acetylcholine receptor this is. And I don't see any G proteins right here, so it's a nicotinic kind of ligand-gated channel. Right? That's a ligand-gated channel. And for a nicotinic ligand-gated channel, what kind of What does it produce in the postsynaptic membrane? You got two choices. EPSPs or IPSPs or both? Ah, three choices, sorry. Only EPSPs, only excitation. It never inhibits, never ever inhibits, right? So acetylcholine binds to this nicotinic channel, causes depolarization, right, which is a, what kind of potential is that when this nicotinic channel opens up? It's an excitatory change in membrane potential, right? It causes a depolarization. But what kind of potential is it? Remember, there are two main kinds of potentials that we were interested in when we looked at a neuron. There were graded potentials and action potentials. Okay, so when this nicotinic channel opens up, does it produce a graded potential or an action potential? Okay, I'm glad I'm going over this. Okay, so when sodium rushes in through this nicotinic channel, it makes a graded potential. Graded potentials are produced by ligand-gated channels. Where do we find ligand-gated channels on a neuron? Dendrites and cell body. Right? So we got to recall from that last test. All right, so that produces a graded potential. And how do graded potentials move over a cell membrane? With decrement, right, they die away. And in a neuron, right, if they die away, by the time they get to the axon hillock, then that information goes away. It's lost. But in the neuromuscular junction, look what we have. Not only do we have ligand-gated channels, we have voltage-gated channels. So as soon as this nicotinic channel is activated by acetylcholine, causing depolarization, guess what happens to this voltage-gated channel? It opens up immediately, right? And that voltage-gated channel causes, what, an EPSP or an IPSP? Only an EPSP, further excitation. And the voltage-gated channel produces what kind of potential? An action potential. So even within the neuromuscular junction, action potential is produced, and it flows over the whole surface of the muscle cell because the whole muscle cell membrane has voltage-gated channels. Right? So the skeletal muscle, as soon as acetylcholine is released, it has no choice but to contract because these voltage-gated channels are in the neuromuscular junction. An action potential is produced right away. It doesn't have to travel over a dendrite or cell body to get to the axon hillock. It just goes, boom, right away. All right, so action potential moves over the cell membrane. Can't get down inside the cell, except that there are transverse tubules. And in that transverse tubule, guess what we have? Voltage-gated channels. And voltage-gated channels produce what kind of potential? Action potential. So action potential comes down through the transverse tubule, okay, and that goes deep inside the cell. There are other kinds of channels within the transverse tubule. There are voltage-gated calcium channels, and sometimes we call those the DHP receptors. They just receive information from the action potential coming down. These DHP receptors, we can see connected to another kind of receptor that we call a ryanodine receptor. That ryanodine receptor kind of goes across between the transverse tubule, and it's also embedded in the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, so that when the DHP receptor changes conformation, it pulls on the ryanodine receptor, and when it does, it opens it up, just like you pulling on that door over there. It opens a doorway. And what's at a high concentration in this terminal cisternae? Calcium, that's right. And when this ryanodine receptor gets pulled open, what happens to that calcium? Moves from high concentration to low. There's a huge gradient, so it rushes out really fast. And as the concentration of calcium increases on the outside of this sarcoplasmic reticulum, it activates even more kind of receptors that we call calcium-induced calcium release channels. That's pretty wordy, right? But this kind of release channel opens up when calcium is around it. And this kind of channel, the calcium-induced calcium release channel, is huge. It's 10 times the size of this ryanodine receptor. And so since it's huge, then that increases the doorway, right, for that diffusion to take place. So even more calcium rushes out. All right, so that's really kind of the end of excitation-contraction coupling. So I think it's pretty interesting for you to realize that in the neuromuscular junction, there are voltage-gated channels, so an action potential is produced right there. and that is radically different compared to what we find at a neuron-neuron synapse, right? Because voltage-gated channels are only found at the axon hillock, down the axon, right? So this skeletal muscle cell gets excitation immediately because that's there. So here's a flow diagram of basically what we've talked about so far that includes troponin and tropomyosin, right? So when ACH is released, acetylcholine is released, binds to those nicotinic receptors, which are always excitatory, produces EPSPs, right? And that's going to induce action potentials because right in that same area are voltage-gated channels. And action potentials then travel all over the surface of the muscle cell, including down into the transverse tubules. And that change in voltage opens up various kinds of calcium channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Calcium diffuses out of the sarcoplasm, out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right, binds to troponin. And that troponin gets tropomyosin out of the way so that the myosin head group can bind to the GE actin. And if there's ATP available, then there's cross-bridge cycling, which means that actin and myosin will slide over each other. All right, so that's the whole process. That is what we call excitation-contraction coupling, right? Starting with an action potential on the somatic motor neuron, right? How many neurons is required in this somatic motor outflow pathway to go from the central nervous system to that skeletal muscle? Only one. Yeah, because we looked at autonomic nervous system. We looked at that. There's only a single one. So what's the effector organ for the somatic motor neuron? It's skeletal muscle, right? Good. So you're putting all that together. That's nice. All right, so we know how to contract muscle. That doesn't help very much if a muscle can't relax. Muscles have to relax, right? Biceps femoris, biceps brachii can't contract unless the triceps brachii does what? Relaxes, right? Because they're antagonistic to each other. So muscle relaxation is very important. And we explain muscle relaxation because of those pumps that pump calcium from the cytosol back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And that's primary active transport. When calcium concentration decreases, then myosin can't grab onto the G-actin anymore because tropomyosin is in the way. All right, who's got a question about that? Anybody got a question about that? A couple exam figures in there? For sure, at least one. All right, so you're good with that. All right, characteristics of muscle contraction. This is going to be important when we get to the heart as well. And heart is a pretty important organ. It might not be your favorite organ in your body, but it should be close, right? Because your heart has to beat your whole life. Can't ever take a break. All right, so let's understand something about muscle contraction. Here I see a graph. And in order to understand a graph, what do we got to understand? The axes of the graph first, right? The axes. What are we looking at? So on the horizontal axis, that's just time. So we're going to look at something versus time, and that something is tension, right? So I see no tension, no tension. All of a sudden, tension in a muscle fiber increases and then decreases. We call that a muscle twitch. And a muscle twitch is produced by just one single fiber, not a whole muscle like the biceps brachii. So I see two twitches that are pretty close together, and what can you tell me about these two twitches? Are they exactly the same size? They are not. So muscle twitches, can they summate or can they not summate? They can summate, right? So twitches can summate, right? So these contractions are what we call graded contractions, right? Because action potentials are exactly the same. Graded potentials can change. So these are graded contractions. A muscle fiber will contract to 100% of its ability. It either contracts or it doesn't contract. So it's kind of hard to understand why they summate. How can the second twitch be stronger than the second? And we explain that because by the time the second twitch happens, there still is calcium floating around in the cytosol. It hasn't all been pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So when another action potential comes down a transverse tubule, it releases an additional amount of calcium, which causes a little bit higher contraction, right? So there's some residual calcium around inside that myofibril. So if we stimulate this muscle fiber more quickly or at a higher frequency, right, so that these twitches come closer together in time, well, they're going to summate even more. Right? And that's what we see on this slide. All right, so again, I see tension versus time and three different kinds of conditions. If we introduce an electrical shock to that muscle fiber at 5 shocks per second, we see it causes a contraction. Okay, and then that contraction starts to go down, but then before it goes down, it's shocked once again. It releases more calcium, produces a higher level of contraction. That process repeats itself until it reaches a plateau region right here, but still, that skeletal muscle fiber relaxes partially in between when we stimulate it. We call this plateau region tetanus, but since it's not absolutely flat, we call that incomplete tetanus. If we increase the number of stimulations, we double it to 10, right? Again, it reaches plateau. What do we call this plateau region? Tetanus. But it's still not a flat line. I can still see some variation in tension that's being produced. That is still what we call incomplete tetanus. Okay, if we increase the frequency of stimulations to 60 shocks per second, notice what happens, right? Then tetanus is complete at this period of time. There's no relaxation whatsoever. Those calcium pumps cannot pump fast enough to get calcium out of the myofibril. There's always high concentration of calcium, which means what? Cross-bridge cycling is taking place. As long as you have ATP available, right? You've got to have ATP available. All right, so that's what we call complete tetanus. We send power around in our society via electricity, which is AC, which means that the voltage goes up and it goes down, goes up and goes down. And does anybody know what the frequency of that variation is? It is 60 cycles per second. Okay, the voltage goes up and down, which on this particular slide is what? The most excitable, the most damaging kind of electrical stimulus there is. It just happened to be that way. Okay, if we transmitted power with a lower frequency, it wouldn't be as damaging to our body, but that's just the way it is, which is sort of interesting. Not an important physiological concept there. All right, so here we see complete tetanus. There's no relaxation, but then look what's happening over here. After a period of time, that muscle fiber starts to get weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker. Of course, we call that fatigue, but you should probably know why that is. Right? Okay. There's no ATP, right? ATP is being used up. Okay. Or ATP is being used up, and so cross-bridge cycling then suffers as a result. There's two kinds of fatigue. There is a physiologic fatigue and a psychological fatigue, right? When you contract the muscle for a long period of time or with a really strong weight, how does that muscle feel? It hurts, right? So that's psychological fatigue. So when a muscle starts to hurt, typically, unless you're a trained athlete, then you have a tendency to let that muscle relax when that happens, right? So that's psychological fatigue. But there's also physiologic fatigue. So no matter what kind of trained athlete you are, there's nothing that you can do to prevent that fatigue from setting in. Okay. Ah, let me talk about something else right here. Tetanus. When this muscle is contracted, right, oxygen isn't getting into that muscle. We call that a spasm, right? Sometimes a Charlie horse. Have you ever had a muscle spasm in some part of your body? Okay, a muscle just contracts. No matter what you do, it doesn't relax. How does that feel when that muscle is contracting, when it's in tetanus? Does it feel good? Like really proud of that muscle? Ooh, look at that nice muscle right there. No, you would do anything to get that muscle to relax because it hurts like hell, right? Hurts really, really bad. So anytime any kind of muscle goes into that tetanus, right, it hurts like hell. Probably doesn't really matter if it's skeletal muscle, smooth muscle, or cardiac muscle. Okay, it just hurts like hell, really bad. I'm going to mention that again a couple other times in other when we get to blood chapter. All right, so that's that. How a muscle contracts, if we just think of it in terms of one fiber, that leads us to a really important principle that we call the length tension relationship. So that just says that the length of a sarcomere before it starts contracting determines what the ultimate tension that can be produced. Right? So that's the length tension relationship. And as a matter of fact, there's an ideal resting length for a sarcomere at which it can generate the most amount of tension. Right? And actually, you already know a lot about this, because in order for filaments to slide over each other, what's the relationship between actin and myosin? Can they be far apart? They cannot. Right? They have to overlap. And when they overlap, what happens to the length of that sarcomere? It shortens, right? Or you can lengthen. So let's take a look and see what happens on this next slide. So here is a plot of tension, right, versus the resting length. And it just says relative over here because a whole bunch of muscles were looked at, and some muscles were, cells were big and some were smaller, and so they were just all normalized so that they could be all considered with the same thought. Right, so here we see this is going to be just the normal resting length, 100%. And that produces quite a bit of tension. Right? And if we let that sarcomere shorten, what happens to the tension that it produces? It starts to decrease, because as it shortens, then the sarcomere can't shorten anymore. It has no place to go. So the amount of tension that it produces becomes less. All right, so let's start back over here at normal resting length. And let's start to stretch that sarcomere. What happens to the performance of that sarcomere when we start to stretch it? It stays the same or it increases. So stretching a sarcomere increases the strength of that particular sarcomere because there's more optimal overlap between actin and myosin. There's more room for them to slide over each other. But then as we pull them farther and farther apart, what can you tell them, what's happening here? Overlap is disappearing. And the tension goes to zero when there is no overlap whatsoever. And that's what you see with this bottom line over here. Okay? This first sarcomere, okay, and here's, you're not so interested in the length, but here's the length of this sarcomere. And this is a shortened sarcomere. It is not stretched. Can this sarcomere contract anymore? There's complete overlap of actin and myosin. The Z-disc can't get any closer together because they're already bumping up against the myosin molecule. So cross bridges can form, but this sarcomere can't shorten, therefore it can't produce tension. Right. So, and right here, I see optimal overlap between actin and myosin. There's a lot of space to where this sarcomere can still shorten. This is the optimum length, which we see over here. And then if we stretch the sarcomere even more, there's no overlap between actin and myosin. And then what happens to the ability of this sarcomere to produce tension? It completely disappears, right? Because there's no overlap. All right. So that's what we call the length-tension relationship. There is a resting length that produces the maximum amount of tension when this muscle works the best. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons why athletes do stretch muscles before activity, right? To get a more optimal overlap of sarcomeres in these various muscles that they're going to be using. Okay, that's going to be really important for the heart, because the heart can stretch. Does anybody know when the heart stretches? And when does the heart shrink down? The heart stretches when it fills with blood, okay? And then the sarcomeres shrink as the heart pumps blood out of it, right? So there are times when the heart is overstretched. When the heart is overstretched, we have a condition like this. What happens to cardiac function when the heart is overstretched? The cardiac function disappears, right? And if the heart doesn't fill properly, then the sarcomeres are too short, and again, it doesn't produce tension, which is bad, right? Because then blood is not being pumped. So the heart will work normally when there's optimal overlap. And so the length-tension relationship in heart muscle pretty much is like this. There's an ascending limb and a descending limb. Right? The descending limb is when the heart is too stretched out. There's an ascending limb when the heart gets weaker because there's not enough blood filling the heart for it to get strong, to pump blood. Then same thing for skeletal muscle. Because you should know that skeletal muscle, or the internal machinery for heart muscle and skeletal muscle, is what? What's the internal machine for contraction in skeletal and cardiac muscle, but not smooth muscle? I got to go over that in this chapter, but maybe you remember from anatomy. Both cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle is striated, which means what does it have? It has sarcomeres. That's right. So cardiac muscle, skeletal muscle have sarcomeres, but smooth muscle does not have sarcomeres. It has overlap of actin and myosin, but in a totally different arrangement. All right, neural control. Well, we know that there is a somatic motor neuron that goes from the spinal cord all the way to a skeletal muscle, right, that effector organ. And we call that a lower motor neuron that leaves the central nervous system. And sometimes we call that the final common pathway because that lower motor neuron is getting information from a lot of places in your body, right? Just not your precentral gyrus, which is the motor gyrus in our frontal lobe, right in front of the central sulcus. It's getting information from all over the place. Some of that information is inhibitory, some is excitatory, and this lower motor neuron integrates all that information, right? Because this lower motor neuron gets graded potentials from all these other inputs. And what can you tell me about all those graded potentials on this lower motor neuron? Graded potentials summate, right? So that lower motor neuron adds all that information up, EPSPs, IPSPs, and then it can generate an action potential to that skeletal muscle. Okay, so there are things in skeletal muscles that can measure how the skeletal muscle is working so that it can give feedback, right, to the central nervous system to tell the central nervous system if your body is behaving the way that it should, right, or the way that you think it should. So there are two kinds of sensors. There's called a muscle spindle apparatus. Muscle spindle apparatus is important for monitoring the length of a muscle, even when it's contracting. And then there's something called a Golgi tendon organ that measures the tension in a tendon, right? And what's a tendon, once again? It's a connection between a bone and a muscle, muscle and a bone, right? Okay, so there are two of these things, muscle spindle and Golgi tendon apparatus. Let's talk about a muscle spindle. Oh, what does a muscle spindle measure, once again? Length of a muscle, right, okay. All right, well, these things are microscopic. I see it in this muscle right here. That's kind of just an illusion, an artist's conception of what a muscle spindle looks like, but it's really microscopic. You can't see it. But this is about where it is, and if we go into this little rectangle over here, really zoom in, I can see some cells, right? So now we have really high magnification. On either side of the muscle spindle apparatus, all right, I see the normal kinds of muscle fibers that contract that we're familiar with. And these are what we're going to call extrafusal fibers, right? Extrafusal fibers are just the normal fibers that cause the muscle to contract. The muscle spindle apparatus over here has intrafusal fibers. I see sarcomeres, so that means that this cell over here can do what if it has sarcomeres? It can contract as well, right? Okay. So you have extrafusal, intrafusal, and you see motor neurons going to both. Here's a somatic motor neuron going to these extrafusal fibers, causing them to contract. Right, we're going to call that an alpha fiber because it just goes to the regular muscle cells. There's another motor neuron that goes into the spindle apparatus that can cause these intrafusal fibers to contract. We're going to call that a gamma motor neuron. All right, so how your brain knows that the muscle is at the proper length is because the gamma fiber and the alpha fiber are activated at the same time, right? And it causes these intrafusal fibers to contract to a proper length, right? And the alpha is going to cause the extrafusal fibers to start to contract. But so the intrafusal fibers are contracted, but if all of a sudden something happens to the skeletal muscle and it's stretched, right, then it's going to pull on these intrafusal fibers because they are contracted. If they didn't contract, you could stretch the skeletal muscle and they wouldn't notice it. But because they're contracted already and you start to stretch them, then there are stretch receptors in these intrafusal fibers that send action potentials back to the brain. And your brain knows that the skeletal muscle is being stretched when you think it is what? Contracted. So that's going to be an important reflex. We're going to call that the stretch reflex. All right, and I think I talked about this already. Okay, coactivation of the alpha and gamma fibers. All right, so here is that stretch reflex. And this is a monosynaptic stretch reflex. What do I see? I see a skeletal muscle. I see a spindle apparatus. What does a spindle apparatus measure? Length of a muscle. Okay, and then my spinal cord. And this blue fiber over here, what do we call this blue fiber? So I see a reflex or a response loop. This right here is an efferent neuron, right? It's part of the efferent. And then here is the afferent or sensory, right? Here's a nice unipolar neuron, right? So the sensory information goes in the dorsal root. Motor information leaves the ventral root all the way down. And remember, only one nerve fiber all the way down to the skeletal muscle. All right, so what about this stretch reflex? We got somebody sitting on a table with their leg kind of hanging down, their knee is bent, and we come next to them without knowing with a hammer, and we pound them in the knee with a hammer, and before they stand up and punch you in the face, what happens to the knee is that it's going to extend. Because tension was placed on this patellar ligament, which pulls on the patella, which pulls on the quadriceps tendon, and that stretches the quadriceps muscle. Right? But the muscle spindle apparatus is at the proper length, and all of a sudden it's being pulled because the quadriceps is being pulled. And so that sends action potentials into, via the afferent pathway, into the central nervous system, saying that the muscle is now stretching, right? Because it's getting that information from the spindle apparatus. That synapses directly on a motor neuron, alpha motor neuron. Where does that alpha motor neuron go to? Extrafusal fibers causing them to contract. All right, so what was the initial stimulus? Was stretch. The response is contraction. And what kind of feedback loop is that? And what does that maintain? The stimulus was stretch. The response is contract. So does the response add to the stimulus or subtract? It subtracts. So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining homeostasis. And notice there's no interneuron here. So this is all just excitatory neurotransmitters being used. So we call this a monosynaptic reflex. The stretch reflex or knee-jerk reflex is a monosynaptic reflex due to activation of the spindle apparatus. Okay. Golgi tendon apparatus is a little bit different, or reflex is a little bit different. Golgi tendon organs are in tendons. All right, so here we see an afferent neuron, right, bringing information in. So the Golgi tendon organ, what does it monitor? Length or tension? It's going to monitor tension, right, different than the spindle apparatus. So it's sending tension information into the central nervous system. Okay, and this sensory neuron synapses on an interneuron, right? So the sensory neuron excites the interneuron, but this interneuron is inhibitory. It's going to release inhibitory neurotransmitter on this common final pathway, this alpha motor neuron going to skeletal muscle. So if it releases inhibitory neurotransmitter, what happens to contraction of this muscle here? It's going to relax. Right, so here is something opposite, completely opposite compared to the stretch reflex. All right, so why is this happening? Well, in this particular case, just let's pretend you're moving a refrigerator with somebody. You're on one end, your friend is on the other end, and refrigerators are really heavy. It's all you can do to hold it up. And then all of a sudden, your friend lets go, slips out of his hands. And then he leaves you doing what? Holding the whole refrigerator by yourself. Well, you can't do that. So all your muscles start to stretch. They're going to rip apart, right, and destroy themselves because you're holding up way too much weight. But what's going to protect you? The Golgi tendon organ right here feels that huge increase of tension way beyond what your body is designed to handle. It sends information into the spinal cord, activates this inhibitory neuron, which then inhibits this somatic motor neuron, which causes your muscles to relax, and then the refrigerator falls on your toe, unless you get out of the way. Okay? So that protects these tendons, right? The insertion of and origins of these tendons and that skeletal muscle from producing so much tension that they get destroyed. Right? So that's the Golgi tendon apparatus. That requires an inhibitory interneuron. Now, this is at the level of the spinal cord. Do you have any perception of what's happening in your spinal cord? Is there any consciousness in your spinal cord? No, you don't have consciousness there. This happens even before you realize it's happening, right? But nonetheless, your spinal cord is controlling various parts of your body, right? Just not through the autonomic nervous system, but through various reflexes. So in the Golgi tendon organ reflex, what's the stimulus? Okay, is going to be tension in the tendon. So tension goes up, and what's going to be the response? Yeah, relaxation, tension goes down, they subtract from each other. That's another nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining homeostasis, right, or the health of this particular muscle. All right, so that's it pretty much for skeletal muscle. So we're going to compare that with cardiac and smooth muscle a little bit. And somebody told me that cardiac and skeletal muscle are pretty similar because they are both striated, right? Which means cardiac muscle has what for shortening? Sarcomeres, right? Actin and myosin arranged in that particular way, right? But remember, cardiac muscle is short. I see a cardiac muscle going from here to here. Skeletal muscle is long, right? Because it's hundreds of cells that have joined together. This is just one cell. Cardiac muscle cell has one nucleus because it's just one cell. It is short, but it is also branched. I see a branch over here. I see branches all over the place. So one cardiac muscle cell exists in different levels or depths within the heart or myocardium. And so that just means that when there's an action potential on a cardiac muscle cell, it just doesn't stay at one level. What does it do? It goes down or it goes up. Right, just like that. So it goes across the wall of the heart. We call that transmural, across the wall of the heart. All right, well, there's something special between the cardiac muscle cells, because if the one on the left contracts, the one on the right contracts, what's going to happen to these two cells? They're going to pull apart, and then you're going to have a hole in your heart. That's not good. So there's a special junction, okay, between these two cardiac muscle cells. Oh, and I'm kind of leading you in the wrong direction. Right, because here's a gap junction, but that's not what I'm talking about. What is that junction called between cardiac muscle cells? Intercalated disc. That's right. Intercalated discs have special connections, physical connections that glue the cells together, but it also has a connection that glues the cells together in an electrical sense. And those are what we call gap junctions. Right? That was what we call an electrical synapse. And these gap junctions are channels between these two cells, and it allows sodium to move from one cell to the next, right? All right, so let's just say that the cell on the right is relaxed, and so there's no depolarization taking place. Let's excite the cell on the left over here, cause it to depolarize by letting sodium diffuse inside the cell, right? That's your typical way of understanding excitation. So sodium gets high inside the cell on the left. Guess what happens to sodium on the cell on the right? Diffuses through the gap junction. When it diffuses through the gap junction, what happens to the membrane voltage? It depolarizes, which you know to be, excitatory, right? And that can cause this cell to contract. But it's not just these cells in a line, but cells above and below, because these cells are branched. This is important because in order for the heart to pump blood, it's got to contract as a unit. One side of the heart can't contract while the other side is relaxing, because the part that's relaxing is going to pump blood to the other side of the heart that's relaxing. It's not going to go to your brain. So the whole heart has to contract so that it ejects blood. The shape of these cells and these gap junctions make sure that the heart contracts as a unit so that it can eject blood when it contracts. If that doesn't work, then the heart is in big trouble. All right, so gap junctions are very important for cardiac muscle. Now, would that be a good idea for skeletal muscle to have gap junctions? No, because I'm really thirsty. I want to grab this Coke bottle over here. And if there are gap junctions between skeletal muscle cells, I reach out to grab that Coke bottle, what's going to happen to all my skeletal muscle cells? They're going to contract, right? And I'm going to die of thirst. So that won't work. Your whole body would go into spasm. So gap junctions like this are important between cardiac muscle cells. So how is excitation-contraction coupling work in a cardiac muscle cell? Well, what's the signal inside of a muscle cell that allows for cross bridges to cycle? ATP is the energy. And calcium. Yeah, so calcium. So as soon as calcium concentration goes up, tropomyosin gets out of the way, right, because calcium binds to troponin. Cardiac muscle has troponin and tropomyosin. So cardiac muscle contraction relies on calcium levels. There is sarcoplasmic reticulum in cardiac muscle. That is a reservoir for calcium, and when the heart is not contracting, these calcium ATP pumps are pumping calcium from low to high concentration back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay. And there are calcium-induced release channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, but there's no ryanodine receptor. There's no physical coupling between the voltage-gated channels, right, in this transverse tubule and a cardiac muscle cell. It's just that when calcium enters the cardiac muscle cell, when an action potential comes down, right, because this is a voltage-gated calcium channel, action potential comes down, then this channel opens up. And where is calcium at a high concentration? Extracellular, so calcium rushes in, because it's usually about zero inside the cell, or really, really close to it. Calcium rushes inside the cell. As calcium surrounds these calcium-induced calcium release channels, they open up. Remember, these things are huge, 10 times the size of these over here. So calcium just floods everywhere around inside these myofibrils, right, causing myosin to bind to actin, and if there's ATP, cycling, and then the sarcomere is going to shorten. So, in terms of skeletal muscle only, where does that calcium come from? From the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? But for cardiac muscle, where does that calcium come from? Sarcoplasmic reticulum and the extracellular source, right? So for normal cardiac functioning, calcium has to come both from the extracellular source and the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Both are important. And if we want to reduce cardiac function because maybe somebody has high blood pressure or something, guess what we can do? We can give them a calcium channel blocker. That's going to reduce the amount of calcium that enters the cell. It's going to reduce tension that the heart produces. Of course, you don't want to overdo it because then their heart won't contract. All right, so calcium channel blockers are a pretty efficient pharmaceutical agent which will block these calcium channels. Does that sort of make sense? Okay. So that's cardiac muscle. Smooth muscle, which is what we see right here, has no sarcomeres. It has actin and myosin. They slide over each other because of cross-bridge cycling. But if we take a look at the smooth muscle cell, okay, I can see that the actin molecules are attached to something that we call dense bodies that are on the plasma membrane in various locations. And it forms a network over the surface of the cell. And cross-bridge cycling, again, happens because of calcium in a little bit different way that we're going to look at. But when a smooth muscle cell is contracting, it's because these dense bodies are pulled closer together. It's like the shrinking of the net on the outside of this particular cell, and the smooth muscle cell contracts. In a smooth muscle cell, there are like 16 times more actin than myosin, and that just allows for a greater stretch and a greater contraction. So here is the arrangement. I see more cross bridges as well. All right, so the nature is that smooth muscle does not have a sarcomere. All right, how does this happen? Well, what binds calcium? What binds calcium in a skeletal muscle cell? Troponin, right? And I said there's a cousin molecule, which was calmodulin. All right, smooth muscle doesn't have troponin. It has calmodulin. Let's see how that works. All right, so here I see a graph of membrane voltage versus time, and I can see the voltage depolarizing and going back down, depolarizing a second time and going back down. Third time, there's depolarization, and now it reaches threshold, and I see action potentials being produced, right, because there are voltage-gated channels. That depolarization causes voltage-gated channels to open in the plasma membrane, not in sarcoplasmic reticulum, but in the cell membrane. So the signal for contraction in smooth muscle comes from an extracellular source, not intracellular. All right, so sarcoplasmic reticulum does not play a role for smooth muscle. Calcium then enters the cell, binds to calmodulin, right? The calmodulin complex will take an inactive kinase enzyme, right, and dephosphorylate it, which is kind of strange, right, because it's activated. Here's a kinase that works by phosphorylating something. We dephosphorylate it, it becomes active. This thing is called myosin light chain kinase. So it's a kinase, which means what? It's going to phosphorylate something. What it's going to phosphorylate is a myosin molecule. And you know, myosin is an important myofilament for contraction. And this light chain doesn't mean that it has light. There's heavy chains and not so heavy chains, right? So this is the lighter of all those chains that in myosin. And when myosin light chain kinase is active, it's going to phosphorylate that myosin. So here it's phosphorylated. When it's phosphorylated, then cross bridges are activated and sliding of the filaments can take place. Right, so calcium still is an important signal for contraction of smooth muscle, but it works through a little bit different mechanism. Right, it works through calmodulin activating various kinds of enzymes, and you know that that is, right, that can be a cascade mechanism, but I just see one level of amplification right here. So since we're turning enzymes on and off, compared to skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle, which is just an electrical event, which muscle do you think contracts faster? The one that's controlled by electrical events or by through various chemical reactions? Electrical events are faster, right? So cardiac muscle, smooth muscle are quick. Smooth muscles are relatively slow. They take time to contract, okay, because it's due to enzyme activity. All right, well, if there's a kinase, we know that we have precise control and balance in our body if what is employed? Biceps, triceps. What's that relationship? Antagonism. That's right. So here we have a mechanism that causes contraction. We should have a mechanism that causes relaxation, right? And so if there's a kinase, what is the opposite kind of enzyme? A phosphatase, right? And that's called myosin phosphatase. That will take the phosphate off. That will go back to just regular old myosin, which then cross bridges won't form. That smooth muscle is going to relax. Myosin phosphatase can flip back and forth between active and inactive forms, and we don't really talk about in this class what controls that. Okay, but this myosin phosphatase pretty much is working all the time, so smooth muscle is relaxed until there is a bigger signal from this calcium calmodulin complex that overrides the phosphatase, and then the smooth muscle is going to contract as a result of that. All right, so smooth muscle, some interesting differences. There's no troponin, but there is calmodulin. For skeletal and cardiac muscle, calcium comes from sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? Exclusively for skeletal muscle, partially for cardiac muscle. But where does calcium come from for contraction of for smooth muscle? It's just the extracellular source. Right? So that's an important distinction. There are different kinds of smooth muscle. There's single and multi-unit. And when we come back next time, we'll talk, it's just one little last thing that we got to talk about in the class. We'll talk about these and then move on to heart, blood, and circulation. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around somewhere. So please sign the sign-in sheet. Before you go, if you have questions, you can ask me.